Mona, I've previously heard you speak about how in the US people sometimes ask, like, why should we care about Kashmir? And you've responded that besides the humanitarian crisis, there's the environmental crisis, and these things really tie us globally.
Well, in some ways, so much has changed since that conversation. Now, almost a year and a half into the pandemic, this assumption seems even more bizarre, right? To think of places as siloed off from each other, as if borders and boundaries are going to protect us from the deep ecological crises or the deep public health crises that we're in. It is clear that places cannot be neatly divided. They're deeply intertwined. And of course, viruses in particular don't recognize borders. The pandemic has made this fundamental fact, I think, amply clear, that whatever you do to seal those borders off, however much infrastructure that you build just to save yourself from the other, it's just not going to work. Our survival is interlinked. This day was particularly hard for me, thinking about my own vulnerabilities here and how those vulnerabilities are, of course, deeply attached to what's happening in Kashmir, not just because I'm Kashmiri, but also as a human being in the US right now, where many people seem to have forgotten what the virus did to the US last year. I'm sorry if I'm digressing.
No, we can't. Like, of course. Go on.
So, there's so much coverage in the international media about what's unfolding in India, which I'm very thankful for because there is a complete clamping down of any form of expression under the Modi regime. But at the same time, I also see what's happening in the US. You see many here now ignoring the disease because it's happening somewhere else. And it can also become, yet again, very easy for the US to frame it as a disease of the third world. So again, we are slipping into those binaries, and there is a reason to be wary, even as I recognize the urgent need for us to hold India accountable for what Arundhati Roy rightly pointed out was these were Modi's crimes against humanity. Going back to that point about being siloed off that I mentioned earlier, viewing Kashmir as its own thing, I feel if you don't see how related we are, how interconnected we are in this moment, 1.5 years into this pandemic, I just don't know what else it's going to take for us to finally get it.
Yeah, like I don't know what's really happening in the US, but Australia just banned like all flights from India because of the pandemic. And but in addition to that, like any Australian citizen who tries to return home after being in India at the moment is being threatened with 5 or 6 years prison. And that's a policy that even figures on the far right in Australia are calling racist.
I mean, it gets complicated, right? What we are seeing in India is this fascist regime in power, and that fascist regime is going to be responsible for not just the annihilation of Indians, but also of Kashmiris. The latter, of course, they won't care for at all. But at the same time, these select people are going to be responsible for this particular strain of virus spreading to many other countries. It's already in 17 other nations. I think it's just a matter of time. That's why I feel questions of politics are so key. Who's in power? What kind of people or regimes are in power? It is such an important question and is often ignored when we think about ecological issues, when we think about public health crises. But if fascism and the multiple crises, we have to understand those connections because it is these connections between fascism and the multiple issues that we're dealing with that we need to be able to grapple with in the future, in the near future. So I don't think we can take care of our climate or our public health without also fixing what is really broken with our political systems, whether it's about the violence of settler colonialism, the violence of occupation, militarism, fascism. Hindu nationalism in the case of the Indian context, racism in Australia, as you just mentioned. I mean, all of those issues are deeply connected, and it's very convenient for policymakers, but also for many people to ignore these connections, to say that we can just fix the climate overnight, or that we can greenwash policies without questioning or challenging what's really rotten at the core. So, I mean, I'm feeling a lot of despair right now, to be honest. The news trickling from Kashmir and from India, friends are in hospitals, literally gasping for air. Some have died. You would think of these apocalyptic scenarios as science fiction. It almost feels like that. It's surreal. I was talking to a friend of mine this morning who said that she wanted to run away. And then she said, but where? Where should I go? I can't breathe. I can't breathe. So we're in a moment where the ground is really, at least seems to be, really shifting beneath our feet. I don't think we have the time or the luxury to figure it all out. I just don't know what it's going to take for us to sink or swim. It would mean a radical restructuring of the global world order, for one, and how nation states function, how these authoritarian regimes survive. And that's the sad part, that despite so much that's happened, people in India, many of them still do not see how whatever is unfolding is connected with the political regime at the center. They still think these issues are disconnected because the virus is somehow seen as a natural biological entity and not seen as a political entity. And sometimes, you know, and many of these narratives actually dismiss it as a conspiracy. So that's I think what is truly at stake.
And like that relationship between the supposedly natural and then the political worlds is something that you've also explored in relation to the 2014 floods in Kashmir, right?
Yes, I did, absolutely. So a lot of people in Kashmir consider the floods you know, in general, people, not just in Kashmir, but in general, we tend to think of these natural calamities such as floods to be natural forces that have nothing to do with politics. But many people do attribute intentionality to floods from multiple, you know, ends of the political spectrum. So, for example, popular Hindu nationalist narratives really characterized floods as this, the Kashmir floods in particular, as this force of nature. This was a flood that was punishing Kashmiris for being anti-national, for being anti-India, anti-Hindu. So that was this big moment of redemption for many Indians. And then there was also this politicization of floods by Kashmiris themselves, which I think actually was much needed because up until 2014, even Kashmiris were not directly connecting ecological crises with the politics of occupation. But I think the 2014 floods was that critical break, that sort of rupture, which really forced many Kashmiris to see that nature could indeed become a weapon, you know, in the hands of the Indian state. There were similar concerns in communities that I worked with in Gurez and Bandipora in North Kashmir, where India was building a 330 megawatt dam called the Kishanganga Dam. The idea was that eventually what the Indian government was trying to do, and this was according to local people, the idea or the fear was that India was trying to eliminate the population entirely from that area and transform this place into an empty borderland. And this would make it much easier for the Indian military to manage people better, manage these landscapes better, transform Gurez entirely into this frontier space, which it already is, but then make it even more so. And control it even more. So there were many of these concerns at the time. This was way back when I was working in the region, 2012, 14, 16, 2018. This was before the abrogation of 370 and 35A in 2019. These dams were being weaponized to shape and restructure the space, to displace populations, and to alter local weather patterns by changing important microclimates. So the dam was making it impossible, for example, for people to grow their staple crops because the land, according to them, had become marshier. It was wetter. And because of the reservoir, the cloud cover was lower and denser and stayed on for longer. And especially in a place like Gurez, which is already a frigid space, you have snow on the ground for 6 to 7 months a year. The worry was that the dam would bring the temperature down even more and making it impossible for people to survive, even those who are not directly impacted or displaced by the dam. So there were all these concerns then related to how dams were indeed being weaponized and used as a way, as I said, to ensure the extermination of people from that landscape.
Where I live, Lake Argyle was formed because of the construction of a dam wall. And the lake is now around 22 times larger than all of Sydney Harbour. And so this huge body of water is held together, literally by sand and stone balancing on top of each other. There's no concrete in the dam wall. And there's a small wedge between two mountains, which they filled in with this stone, and that was sourced after blowing another mountain, after blowing up another mountain. And that was the largest non-nuclear explosion in Australian history. Like, now it's often valorized as a piece of engineering genius, but the dam is barely utilized, and it flooded huge tracts of land here in the 1970s, like Indigenous land, inhabited land, predominantly on Mirrawong country. At that point in time, no Mirrawong people were consulted. And like exactly what you're saying, people's homes, their agricultural systems, the roads with which they journeyed from one place to another and connected for ceremonies and trade with other people, all of this was basically disappeared under the water. A report I read by the Kimberley Land Council, which is an Indigenous organisation, compared the trauma of this event to a natural disaster, but said it was only worse because there was no recovery process that followed. There was one house on the cattle station owned by the colonists, the Durack family, who actually played a vital role in the formation of this dam. And of course, their house was relocated and turned into a museum that now sits above the dam. But there's no mention of Mirrawong loss in this colonial sphere. The whole lake itself is now largely seen by tourists, as well as non-Indigenous residents, as a place of immense beauty, a place to take their boats out on the weekend. And all of this really turns my gut. And that's where a lot of my work is trying to scratch at. Somewhere else you wrote about the settler colonial fantasy. And I've been thinking about this same thing as kind of colonial dreams and how they materialize through forms of leisure and by extension tourism, but also development, and how inherently and deeply violent these things are. Lake Argyle, the dam, was also weaponized by the Australian state to consolidate and expand its ability to exist in this region. Like, I like what you wrote about how things like sand and gravel are not apolitical, but materials that hold political ideologies in place. And so this dam is actually what enabled the establishment of the town that I now live near. The dam enabled colonization to flourish here. And without the dam, the town and the non-Indigenous world it forged wouldn't be feasible. There are a lot of elements of your work in Kashmir that resonate with where I live. An awful lot of energy goes into maintaining this colonial settlement here. And a large impetus behind creating the dam in the 60s and 70s was to secure colonization in the northwest of Australia, to be able to control this region, and was particularly driven by the fear of an Asian invasion coming into Australia from Indonesia. Like, up until the 1970s, this part of the continent wasn't really fully governed. And in some senses, this is still true today. But I also think of tourism, which brings me to the tulip gardens in Kashmir, images of which recently flooded our social media feeds.
Yeah, I was looking at your photos, and I know a lot of this work focused on leisure, people just lounging around in the water. There's a distinct whiteness to it, in that context, especially as it relates to nudity or being partially naked or wearing your bikinis. In the Indian context, you often also see very similar things happen around pilgrimages, hordes of people. Hindu pilgrims storm in from India and take a bath in the open in Kashmir's rivers. That juxtaposition of nudity against Kashmir's pastoral landscape is a violent intervention, I feel, through body cells. The Tulip Garden was exactly that. I remember these photos being posted on Facebook. The tulips in this context are a symbol of the Indian occupation, these manicured rows of them, right? They become soldier-like almost in their manicured context. I felt the same sort of emotion looking at these airport photos with a sea of people in the middle of a pandemic just coming into Kashmir to do what, right? Is it to seek refuge or is it to become the organic weapon that carries the virus to Kashmiris, even as they themselves might be vulnerable? The tulips are a particularly interesting feature of that colonial landscape. There were people in Kashmir posting photos of other kinds of flowers that are indigenous and that are found in Kashmir. And they were claiming them as their tulips. To recognize that this very crafted, manufactured landscape or manufactured wilderness, if you will, is a way to hide the deep violence that it embodies and it carries with it is, I think, a critical exercise. It's also very strange. There's these photos of the tulip garden in my head as we speak. There's one in particular where after the gates to the garden were closed, there's a bunch of Indian tourists literally climbing the walls
Yeah, I saw that.
to be. Yeah, and it is this Indian obsession with the Kashmiri landscape at whatever cost, even your own health. These people are fixing their gaze onto an element of a landscape that they think is Kashmiri, which they want to own. It's an expression of ownership by whatever means necessary. On the other hand, I really wonder, where does that obsession come from? Are people that starved for a glimpse of the tulip? I want to ask, what are you doing? Where does that feeling of being starved or feeling starved even come from? What political work, right, needs to go into that? I just didn't know what to do with that picture of those tourists climbing up the garden wall. It actually made me sad about what these people are doing to themselves, not just to Kashmiris or to the landscape, but to their own selves.
Yeah, like when I was making my own images, I was thinking about that sense of entitlement, white entitlement. And I hadn't thought of it along the lines of starvation, but more along the lines of consumption and greed. But maybe starvation is an interesting frame in this context.
Yes, I think it's gluttony, right?
Yeah, gluttony.
That's the word. It's not, you're right, it's not starvation per se. It is this feeling of experiencing some degree of starvation, which then forces you to be gluttonous. And colonialism is fundamentally about gluttony. You want more, you thrive on excess, you always want more because you can never ever be satisfied with what you have. You can never say, okay, this is it, because colonial empires need to be fed constantly.
I think that extends to the idea of development as well, in the sense that things have constantly got to progress. It's key to that ideology. There's never any pause. The black and white photos from In the National Interest are of these gravel pits that dot most of the highways where I live. They're basically dug up to produce gravel that then produces the roads, which become the kind of veins or roots of colonization. Roads enable settlement and connection between other parts of the settlement, but roads are also the things that allow people to journey to the springs that I've depicted in All the Violence Within This, the color photographs. And so, on the one hand, when I was making these images, there was this sense of lushness, of richness and beauty that the springs evoke in that green landscape. But our engagement with that is coming at the cost of this very dystopic underbelly of development too. And when I made these works, I was thinking through things like tourism and development as weapons used by the state. But through making the work, as I went deeper, I realized I was also touching on environmental issues and their interconnectedness. And this is something central to your work. Do you want to talk a little bit about the relationship between environmentalism and self-determination in Kashmir?
Yes, I mean, I do want to speak to that, but I also want to go back just briefly to the black and white images, because as I am looking through them, you know what I'm reminded of? These huge craters on the highway that connects Bandipora with Gurez, where land has been dug up to supply the gravel and the soil or the sand from the rivers or mountains to the dam. Sand has become a big issue in Kashmir, especially after 5th August of 2019, because there's a lot of sand mining now that's happening, and those contracts have now gone to Indians.
Yeah, I've seen some pretty horrible photos of that.
Yeah, I actually didn't even know until I started working in Gurez how important sand from the Kishanganga River was as a resource and how much people actually relied on it, not just for their livelihood, but also to build their own homes. The digging up of gravel and soil and sand, those are the images that really struck because they really struck me because they remind you of these scarred landscapes. These are scars of capitalism, of neoliberalism, of militarism, where all the gluttony has left a void. It's like what used to be and what now just does not, it doesn't exist anymore. But you know, interestingly, in 2014, right after the floods, I was in Kashmir and I went to Uri.
Oh,
you've been to Uri, right? And I wrote this piece with Pervez Bukhari, who is a Kashmiri journalist and a dear friend of mine. What had happened in Uri was that the National Hydroelectric Power Corporation, the NHPC, had built a dam way back in the 1990s, and they had deposited all this gravel, the concrete, and the muck in one place, but never properly disposed it off. So it created this big hill on the edge of the village. The muck had been sitting there for years, and then in 2014, because of the floods, it suddenly collapsed. And because it collapsed, there were these boulders and stones and trunks, twigs that came crashing down and altered the course of the river. Now, all this muck settled on the river and cut it. It sliced the river, but it also made agricultural land completely useless. So people lost vast portions of their prime land. What was interesting in 2014 was how one of the key people who we met there, Razia, who we write about in that co-authored piece, was trying her very best to file a case against the NHPC for its negligence, for the improper disposal of this muck that had now finally ruined their village and the land that they cultivated many, many years after the dam was commissioned. Unfortunately, nothing came out of the case because village politics also somehow got in the way. But I mean, this is to say that the life of that muck, the life of gravel, the life of concrete, the life of sand, it extends beyond what might first think or anticipate. In that sense, the ground reanimates a particular kind of resistance, at least at the local level, where people are connecting that muck with those memories of the NHPC's building of the dam. It's almost like you're looking at an archive in the muck, which was just sitting quietly. And now because of the floods, all of these pieces of memory are coming together, fragments of it everywhere for people to then piece together. I hadn't realized this, but it comes back to the agency of these non-human forces. Floods can damage your land for good because you do need a lot of human power, a lot of machines in some cases to clear the land. And often the phrase that I hear people say is that a land is not just there, you make land, right? You literally make land to help land grow crops, for example. It's not just there. And I feel that's the other sort of settler colonial fantasy or misperception, that the land is there. It's always been there. You just need to go and claim it. So that's, I feel, it's this crucial difference between claiming land and working on it, engaging with it, or claiming it and understanding the way it speaks to this relatedness between humans and landscapes. So that's completely, unfortunately, this relatedness is completely absent in these colonial narratives of consumption, gluttony, or obsession. When I was looking at the photographs, so much of it resonated with what I know of and from Kashmir, especially that one picture with that tree standing still. I thought it was very poignant and telling because it speaks to me of persistence, an important ethic and practice in indigenous lives. I know a lot of people talk about erasure and elimination, and I do too, but that also makes it seem as if indigenous people are people of the past. Within indigenous groups in the United States and elsewhere, many scholars have turned to studies of persistence. What kinds of forums and expressions allow indigenous communities to persist, to continue to live, continue to exist, to be visible, to be known? So that tree just made me think about persistent in ways that resonated with me quite a bit. After the dam was commissioned and the reservoir literally just ate up the village and devoured the entire, all the households. There was this one building, the ruins of a mosque. In fact, the only building that hadn't fully been consumed by the reservoir. For many people in the village, it meant something. There was talk about it in some of the prayers. The journey to that site became almost a daily pilgrimage. There were a lot of people who were resettled after they were displaced and after their homes were devoured by the reservoir. But they, in particular, made it a point to walk to the ruins every night, every day. And until they did that, they didn't feel fully alive. So this theme of persistence is something I'm very interested in, especially at a time when Kashmiris are feeling nothing but despair. And given the extent of the draconian reach of the state under Modi and with COVID, for personal reasons, I'm still very invested in this idea of how do we persist despite the violence.
Where I live, like, exists between the desert and the tropics, so I'm kind of in a savanna in the middle, and so we get a big wet season for 3 or 4 months every year, and then we get 8 months of literally like zero rain, and towards the end of that period we get fires. You spoke before about this idea of making land. In Australia, Indigenous people largely manage the country through fire via strategic burning. And though this management was weakened by colonization, today fires and floods are an almost like annual thing where I live, sometimes at a devastating level, but not always. And I often think about how the country itself really rejuvenates after a flood and a fire, whereas all the colonial apparatus of roads and buildings have to constantly be maintained. Road signs are burnt almost annually, and large chunks of road are often turned over by floodwater. It's a reminder of how the colonial state needs to constantly kind of maintain its presence here.
Well, that's such a great example. I mean, the highway that connects Jammu with Kashmir, the kind of upkeep that that highway requires, the money and the lives that it consumes, it's absolutely unreal. And yet the highway serves as a constant reminder of how the connections between India and Kashmir are so forced. Our ancestors in Kashmir used to say this, that the more organic route is actually on the other side, that connects Kashmir with Pakistan. That route could actually become an all-weather road. That's how the mountains are laid. That's how Kashmiris claim their rivers and glaciers have carved out those parts organically over the years. But this highway between Jammu has taken so much from them, they say. So many people I know have died on that highway. I like that idea of the constant upkeep because it's not just the upkeep of power, of roads or infrastructure, but it's also in turn what that infrastructure is allowing you to demonstrate, which is or maintain, which is precisely that, it's power, right?
Yeah. A lot of the things we're talking about, like sand or gravel and roads, or even things like tourism, they seem like pretty banal things, but as you've spoken about, these are things that are weaponized. And I guess a lot of my work in Australia is about trying to make visible this weaponization and the inherent violence in my own settler colonial culture. But sometimes when I talk to other non-Indigenous people about this, they're quite taken aback at the idea of their lives being wrapped up in this violence that they commonly see as historic and not ongoing or present. There's an inability to see ourselves here and now, I think. So I'm kind of wondering, like, how important is it for you, if we think about those people visiting the tulip gardens, which you referred to earlier as organic weapons carriers, carriers of the virus, how important is it that people recognize this in themselves?
Well, I think that's fundamental, right, to any radical re-envisioning of our society and politics. And I think that's the most difficult thing, though, in all my years of teaching, even. I say this to my students all the time. The hardest thing is to step outside of yourself and see yourself from outside in, and then to recognize your own privileges. It's hard sometimes to fully take cognizance of what ways one might be privileged. I think that's the hardest thing. But in this case, it's not even about privilege. It's about this deep sense of entitlement that something is yours and it's somehow inherently yours. I wonder about this all the time. Where does this sense of entitlement come from? Unfortunately, part of it is also, I think, because of this colonial idea of Kashmir as Indian, as part of the Indian sacred geography that many Hindus embrace uncritically. And that's where the notion of indigeneity gets complicated in Kashmir, because a lot of Indian Hindus assert Kashmir's past as solely Hindu and use this ideology to legitimize the violent extermination of Kashmiri Muslims. So I think it's important to keep in mind how indigeneity itself can become a weapon used by the Indian Hindu state and has been used, unfortunately, in the past and continues to be used against marginal populations in India, but also in Kashmir. And coming back to your question, how important is it for conversations like this to happen? How important is it for Indians to recognize how colonial that need to consume Kashmir is, and in what forms and shapes it expresses itself, whether it's through gazing at tulips or the Shikhara or the Dal Lake or Gulmarg or these glacial landscapes in Kashmir? It's that voracious right or entitlement to consume that drives the colonial gluttony.
Going back to that photograph of the Indian tourists climbing the gates of the tulip gardens, during a discussion I heard between you and Muhammad Junaid, the two of you spoke about how in many ways, because of the political ideology that dominates, India is in fact more colonized than the Kashmir it's attempting to colonize, and that despite the extent of the military occupation, there really are areas of life within Kashmir that remain far less colonized than India itself.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think to answer this question, I come back to this notion of persistence. So is this claim of the colonial power total? Is it absolute? Can it ever be absolute? Or can we see that there are forces in Kashmir, whether they're human forces or more than human forces, that defy that totality? The totality of domination. I speak about that in relation to Jinn in Kashmir, going back to Udi for a brief second, when Razia, for example, saw her landscape completely devastated, her cultivable land completely gone. She spoke to me about meeting a Jinn who had come to her from far, far away, from this particular land that she used to go to with her dad. She used to visit that land. And now is completely inaccessible. due to the density and scale of militarized infrastructure. So Rasia spoke about how this jinn empowered her to fix the land. She brought in bulldozers after the floods and is actually one of the few female contractors in Kashmir that I know of. But she speaks of this experience with the jinn who inspired her to reconnect, to think of this geography beyond its securitization, beyond the logics of military domination and security infrastructure. Because what the jinn did was traverse these spaces and timescales that were hard for humans to traverse. So for Razia, but also for many other communities in Kashmir I worked with, the landscape is something that has a lot of spiritual merit and power. And that has stayed with me. The curse of that landscape on people can be palpable. Something I'm still working through is this idea of how, because Kashmir has these four unique seasons, for instance, right? The weather itself becomes and is so different from the rest of India that Indians don't know how to cope with it. I saw this during my work in Kargil, for example, where border communities would constantly tell me how during the Kargil War, it was impossible for Indian soldiers to scale up the mountains because they just didn't know how to do it. Some soldiers had not even seen snow, they said to me, let alone climbed up glaciers and Kargil's high mountain peaks. So there is this inability to survive in what the military, for example, describes as hostile weather conditions. But what does that mean, right? What does it mean to call something hostile? When in fact, that's the weather people have lived with all their lives. That's the weather they know. That's the weather they admire, the weather they like. They might complain about it like we all do about weather, but that doesn't mean it is hostile. It's not strange. It's not the other. It's their own. But every time you open up a military manual, the glacier is seen as hostile. It's also, of course, it reminds me of what settlers here did in the US, renamed indigenous places to signify or reinterpret them as dead or as empty or dangerous. They gave colonial names, imposed names onto landscape features that were part of people's intimate social lives. And to me, one of the worst forms of violence, especially in frontier areas or border areas of Kashmir, is that many younger people do not use local names for the mountains anymore or for other landscape features. There are names for the mountains in the local language that were based on the location of particular nalas, which are tracks that glaciers carve out in the mountains. But now the mountains have these military names. They're named after military installations or cantonments or the battalions. So there's Brigade 1, there's Brigade 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And that to me is a very deep form of violence.
Yeah, that's all over Australia as well. I mean, it's changing gradually with Indigenous place names sometimes being reinstated. But there's so much pushback around that too, with non-Indigenous people getting grumpy at having to change the name of a place that they might have known for 40 years or so, but they're unable to grasp that the Indigenous name is potentially tens of thousands of years old. And further, like where I live, Weber Plain Road is this road named after two brothers who murdered Indigenous people. Like many say, in a massacre that was pretty large. And there's been some push within the community to change the name of this road, but counter arguments always claim that there's no concrete evidence these settlers were murderers to begin with. And so, like, again, like oral histories are still not respected in the same way as written ones. So the kind of colonial names remain.
Yeah, I feel that sadness can also bring some clarity of thought. Though I don't know that any of us need more clarity. It's baffling to me that people who are sick right now with COVID and they're not sure whether they're going to live or not can still defend Modi. That's baffling. That's like this whole level of sacrifice or subservience that is hard to fathom. It's a whole new both level of worship, but also the scale.
Yeah, I think it was yesterday, Arundhati Roy published a piece asking Modi to resign. And I felt that it was just such a direct, plain, like desperate piece. It made me really like,
I know, yeah.
Sad.
Yeah. No, I know that's a great way to explain it. It was desperate, right? And coming from her, and the fact that she said, just do whatever it takes, bring the RSS on board, but do whatever it takes, just leave. I can hear that desperation in everyone's voices. The virus is not a great equalizer in any way. It's obviously impacting the poor and the marginal more, and will continue to impact them more for years to come. But in some ways, it also doesn't discriminate in the same ways that something else might. I think I'm still wrapping my head around this. There's a part of me that thinks, of course, it's discriminating. It's not impacting people equally. And yet there's a part of it that can, because, you know, it's got this energy. It's got this agency that we cannot fully control or predict or claim. So it can change course. There's a part of it that can get you regardless of who you are. And I think that is its strength in a moment like this. But it is also something that we just don't know how to live with. These are strange times.
Yeah. Those black and white photos with my son running around in a couple of them as well. Like, it does feel like this dystopic world, which our lives are producing, that he's going to have to reckon with, like that real dystopia. If it's not already here, it's hurtling towards us right now.
Yeah, no, actually, I love that photo. It's also left a deep imprint on my mind, but I feel there's also some hope there.
Yeah,
you
like,
know, it's,
he can do it.
Yeah, it's open. It's an embrace. It seems like an empty landscape, and yet he's running towards it, wanting to embrace it. And I don't know what it is about. Maybe it is that age. Maybe it is that generation that somehow already know that they have inherited a broken, damaged planet. I have a seven-year-old, and I've seen him now for a year talking about death in a very matter-of-fact way. It also alarms me. He wants all the details when someone is dead. I call him our census taker in the family. It is this normalization of death in his life on a day-to-day basis. It's insane. We talk about death every day in this family. And this is something that's been happening for a year and a half, whether it was because of protests, police brutalities in the US. I mean, all forms of death, not just COVID. Last year, we had this big Kashmir protest in New York City, and he was there. He was only six at the time, but it's left such a deep impression on him. Every time Kashmiris now get together, he'll say, are we protesting? But there's resilience and resistance in that too, I think.
Definitely. There's a hope in the embrace, in the running towards, like in knowing the detail, in wanting to know the detail. Not that we want our kids to inherit a broken world, but I guess it's undeniable that the world is broken and breaking. And I want to give my son the capacity to somehow like run at it still.
Yeah, no, I think about extinction a lot, and I do feel that it's in the future for humanity. I don't think that's cynical at all. I think that's just the way things are going. To your point, the world is broken already. The question is, what will they do with that broken world? To what extent are they able to pick up the pieces and build something new? And how do we prepare them for that? I think about this question a lot as a mother to a seven-year-old. I'm not in the camp that believes that we need to protect our kids from the world. They have inherited it and in the manner that it is broken.
There was a paragraph in one of your pieces, and I'm not sure I'm going to find it right now, but it was this paragraph on conceptions of freedom. And the older women were recalling spending hours each day in the forest gathering wood, grass, fruit, and herbs. And the idea of freedom that you evoked in these paragraphs through these women, I found so beautiful. Like, I felt exactly like it felt exactly like what we need right now.
Yeah, no, I think that's what these women meant. They would tell me often that the dam had limited them, their movement, limited the ways they connect with the mountains and their forests and their glaciers. Well, that's because there's so much concrete and infrastructure now that cuts off the landscape in very haphazard ways. At the same time, it's also because the landscape is populated by outsiders, like engineers who are working there, and they come from all over India and even outside of India. So notions of modesty become important to these women, and they don't feel comfortable enough to step out of their homes. So they spoke of the openness of the fields and just being able to, exactly like your son, run with this open-armed embrace.